We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
Rudy Giuliani was interviewed last night by Fox News host Sean Hannity. And I don't want to say Giuliani screwed Trump, but Michael Cohen gave him $130,000.
From 30 Rockefeller Plaza in New York City, please enjoy this podcast edition of Late Night with Seth Meyers. On today's show, Seth talks to writer-comedian Mike O'Brien, creator of the NBC sitcom AP Bio. And as an added bonus just for this podcast, Seth and Mike continue the conversation backstage at Studio 8G. But first, a closer look.
President Trump's top shelf legal team is at it again. His lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, went on TV last night and defended him by telling everyone he lied about paying hush money to a porn star. For more on this, it's time for a closer look. The Trump presidency is starting to feel like a TV show that's out of ideas and recycling old characters. First, Michael Cohen was back in the news, then Trump's doctor reappeared, and 2 weeks ago, it was reported that former New York Mayor Rudy Giuliani had joined Trump's legal team. There's no doubt that Trump has a crack legal team, and by that I mean every time one of his lawyers is on my TV, the screen cracks. But hey, it made sense. When you hire a lawyer, you want someone who's calm, level-headed, and analytical. Someone who will follow the facts wherever they go. And Giuliani was definitely the man for the job, as he made clear 2 years ago in this super chill, laid-back, fact-filled speech to the Republican National Convention.
What happened to, there's no black America, there's no white America, there is just America! This is a man with a big heart who loves people, all people, from the top to the bottom, from the middle to the side. Islamic extremist terrorism, you know who you are! And we're coming to get you for an America headed in a different direction. Greatness! Where did it go? How was it flown away? We are giving them the money. Are we crazy?
You are. But what I will say, God bless him, though. I hope I have that much energy when I'm 200 years old. I love that Trump saw that and thought, get that guy in a room with Mueller. And then I'm sure someone else was like, shouldn't we make sure he knows the difference between top and bottom? Seriously, can you imagine Giuliani meeting with Robert Mueller? Judging from the amount of spittle in that clip, Mueller's gonna need to wear goggles. And as soon as he took the job, Giuliani had a lot on his plate because he's not just dealing with the Russia probe, there's also the investigation of Trump's personal attorney, Michael Cohen, who orchestrated the hush payment to porn star Stormy Daniels, whose real name is Stephanie Clifford. Now, Trump has been very clear about one thing. He had nothing to do with the payment to Daniels, and he didn't give Cohen the money. He said as much to reporters on Air Force One just last month.
Mr. President, did you know about the $130,000 payment to Stormy Daniels? Then why did Michael Cohen make it if there was no
true
trial
payment? Well, you have to ask Michael Cohen. Michael's my attorney, and you'll have to ask Michael.
Do you know where he got the money to make that payment?
No, I don't know.
Just think, he could have avoided that whole interview if the bathroom hadn't been occupied.
You look, you'll have to ask Michael. Come on, hurry up in there.
So there you have it. Trump was very clear on multiple occasions. He told the American people point blank he had nothing to do with the Stormy Daniels payment, didn't know where the money came from, and the Cohen investigation had nothing to do with him. At least that was his story until last night when Mulberry Street Dracula over here went on Sean Hannity's show on Fox News. And the best part is Hannity didn't even ask Giuliani about the Cohen investigation. He was asking Giuliani about the infamous dossier on Trump's ties to Russia, and yet for some reason, Giuliani went out of his way to bring up the Stormy Daniels payment. All he had to do to avoid undercutting Trump was not say that the president repaid the money.
Are you concerned that that was paid for to manipulate the American people in the lead up to an election?
Isn't that closer to the mandate than Michael Cohen?
Why isn't that having something? Where's Mueller on that, sir?
Having something to do with paying some Stormy Daniels woman $130,000? I mean, which is going to turn out to be perfectly legal. That money was not campaign money. Sorry, I'm giving you a fact now that you don't know. It's not campaign money. No campaign finance violation. So
they funneled it through the law firm.
Funneled through the law firm, and the president repaid it.
Rudy, what is wrong with you? You're the president's lawyer, and you just told everyone he lied on TV. On Sean Hannity's show, you cracked under no pressure. If Rudy Giuliani had been OJ's lawyer, he would have said, hey, even if your gloves don't fit, you can still stab somebody. Also, you know Hannity can't believe he accidentally made news on his show. Listen to him off camera after Rudy says the president paid Cohen back.
They funneled it through the law firm.
Funneled through the law firm, and the president repaid it.
Oh, I didn't know he did.
Yeah.
Oh, what? Huh? Sean Hannity is the only guy who would say, dear God, what have I done, when what he has done is journalism. But Rudy was apparently... Rudy was apparently in a sharing mood because he went on to explain that paying hush money to porn stars was a standard transaction for lawyers and therefore could not possibly violate campaign finance laws.
Do you know the president didn't know about this? I believe that's what
Michael
said.
He didn't know about the specifics of it, as far as I know. But he did know about the general arrangement that Michael would take care of things like this, like I take care of things like this for my clients.
That's your defense? Michael Cohen paid off a porn star for his client. We all do that. That's first day of law school stuff. So Rudy's argument is that this hush payment was not illegal because it was not a campaign contribution and didn't need to be reported. It was just a private transaction. It had nothing to do with politics. That's the most important part of his case. It was personal, not political. So all Rudy had to do was make sure he didn't bring up the campaign.
If we had to defend this as not being a campaign contribution, I think we could do that. This was for personal reasons. This was the president had been hurt personally, not politically, personally so much.
You're saying that Stephanie Clifford made these allegations, told Donald Trump's lawyer, look, I'm denied them, public.
And denied them, and then said it wasn't true. However, imagine if that came out on October 15th, 2016, sure. In the middle of the, you know, last debate with Hillary Clinton.
So during the campaign, Rudy, what is wrong with you? You just made the prosecutor's case for them. The feds were probably watching that interview and saying,
we're coming to get you!
So now the president's lawyer has admitted that the president lied when he said he had nothing to do with the Stormy Daniels hush payment, and yet Trump's supporters have been twisting themselves in knots to justify his lies. For example, right after that interview aired, Arizona Republican Congressman Andy Biggs had this to say about Giuliani's admission.
I don't think somebody with President Trump's income level actually maybe writes all his checks. You know what I mean? It would not surprise me if he authorized the payment and, you know, it just gets kind of lost in the shuffle. I know that sounds crazy, perhaps, on a certain level.
No, it sounds crazy on every level. And it begs the question, if a $130,000 payment to a porn star can get lost in the shuffle, what else is in the shuffle? Seriously, how do you lose track of a hush payment to a porn star? Can you imagine Trump with a green visor trying to balance his checkbook?
Let's see, $100 for electricity, $85 for cable, okay, $130,000. What's this for? Honey, do you know what the hundred? Oh, never mind, honey. For fun stuff.
But the question still stands, why did Giuliani do this? And here's what I think is going on. Every time someone in Trump's orbit gets a close-up look at the Mueller investigation, they freak out. Remember Sam Nunberg or Carter Page? Once they saw how serious Mueller's team was, they went on TV and had meltdowns. And the same thing is happening with Giuliani because it's finally dawning on them that this investigation isn't going away anytime soon. Just last night, another former Trump aide, Michael Caputo, went on CNN after being interviewed by Mueller's team and stressed repeatedly how tenacious investigators were.
I think the Mueller team knew more about what I did in 2016 than I knew myself. And I think they know more about the Trump campaign than anyone that ever worked there. These guys have got every single email, anything that's ever gone down. And they're clearly focused on trying to identify some Russian collusion.
Can I just ask, how long were you there?
I was there 3 hours. I would compare it to a proctology appointment.
Well, that makes sense because Trump is definitely pulling his answers out of his ass. So Trump's own lawyer is now telling us that he lied about a hush payment to a porn star, which raises the question, what else is he lying about? At this point, we should just assume the answer is everything. And if Trump thought hiring Giuliani would save him, he was wrong, because so far, Giuliani has proved that he's crazy from
the top to the bottom, from the middle to the side.
This has been A Closer Look. Our guest is a very funny comedian and writer who you know from his work on Saturday Night Live. He's the creator of the NBC comedy series AP Bio. The season finale airs Thursday night at 8:30. Please welcome back to the show our very good friend, Mike O'Brien, everybody. Hi, buddy.
Hey, how are you?
Good. I'm so happy to see you. I have been very lucky to know you for a long time. You wrote on SNL, and I actually was lucky enough to be the guy who called you to tell you you got the job.
That's very true. I you know this, but they don't. When the call came in, I was literally getting out of a car and entering an elevator at Northwestern Hospital in Chicago to go meet my sister Erin's brand newborn, Liam, her oldest. A big deal for the family. Everyone was gathered there. The headline of the day was definitely, Erin has a child. And I had to kind of try to figure out at what point I should drop that there's another headline. It's like, also, I got hired to SNL. I'm moving in 3 days. But this is probably harder to do. Is it, though? I mean, I had to work really hard.
You had to work really hard. And now you created this show, AP Bio. You wrote the pilot yourself, and then you are the showrunner. So you have a writing staff, but you basically are in charge of the show. How has it been running a sitcom?
Well, and first off, in that question, you left out that at some point I was like, Seth, will you come? Oh, please help, 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 help.
Yeah, yes, I'm very Seth, lucky to be a producer on the show, but you do all the work. Yes.
Very nice. Running it was actually a blast. I had the best time. We had a wonderful writer's room, and NBC is just the greatest network on earth. We had a great relationship with the network. Yeah. And
We don't know yet if we have a season two, so this
correct.
Is all very positive to
that's
say.
That's correct, yeah. The minute we get a season two, I'm going to gossip my head off about them. It couldn't have been smoother. It was so fun.
How do you feel like you were as a boss being in charge of a writer's room and everything else that goes with having a show?
I think I was probably a very chill and nice boss for everyone. What I need to work on is the occasional jerk boss move, and
oh, you think you need it in your arsenal to be a jerk boss?
I think so, probably. Yeah. And this isn't one of the preset things. I don't have a joke to follow this. I just am saying.
You're just realizing now.
I'm just thinking about it. I'm like, I think the one thing is, I'm like, is everyone happy? Is everyone okay? And sometimes I think you have to. Well, you're kind of the boss of the show. You have to lay into people sometimes, right?
Yeah. No, you have to hire a guy to do that.
Oh, got it. I'll just do that then. Yeah, that
you just
better.
Need a guy, right? And, like, he goes in and lays into everybody, and then after he's done, you walk in and you're like, what
was that? I know that the last time I was on this show, all I did was rip on Betty White, and I don't want to use a lot of my time on it, but that is exactly what she does. Betty White is this dumb older actress that hosted SNL once, and she didn't like my sketch, and she had this, like, 95-year-old manager who was like, you can't do this! And she was like, I think he's... And I was like, oh, you two just met Betty? I swore I wouldn't go down this road!
It's so hard to see you and not have that come up.
I'm so mad still, and yet she lives on forever.
She's going to live forever. Yeah, she's definitely going to be at your funeral.
For sure. For sure.
So I do want to ask about, because, again, you made another, we all know how you feel about Betty White. You made a more subtle observation with another friend of ours who wrote on the show. I believe Tim Robinson is who you had this
observation. Yes.
And we won't name names, but there are a lot of British people who host SNL. And they have an opinion about their American accents.
Yes. British people all think their American accents are the best. And so you would get a British host of SNL and you'd give the sketch and they're like, well, I'm being British. And by the way, my British accent is bad, but at least I'm saying it.
Yeah.
And they're like, oh, well, I'm doing my British accent in all these other sketches. Maybe I'm American in this one. And we're like, sure, yeah, whatever helps, get it on. Yeah, yeah. And there, one particular guy was like, well, should I be Tennessee or, like, Eastern Tennessee? And we're like, oh, wow, you know that nuance. Yeah, I guess let's hear Eastern Tennessee. That sounds fine. And he's like, okay. I do not like that. And you're like, that's nowhere on earth. That's not East or West Tennessee, but.
I'm sorry about that, because the sketch probably didn't go that well once that happened.
It got immediately, like, the audience was like, what is this supposed to be? Where is he supposed to, what planet is he supposed to be from? And also, Tim should have done it, probably, because it was a very Tim.
Yeah, Tim sketch. You had a comedy album, Tasty Radio.
Yep.
You read on George Saunders' Book on Tape, Lincoln and the Bardo.
Yes.
You have a book on tape idea.
Yes. I love books on tape. I find, like, ADD or whatever, it's easier to listen to books on tape. And I've been obsessed with the idea that I wonder what it would be like if the Kama Sutra did books on tape. And I think it would go like this. I think it'd be like, okie doke, first page I'm looking at here. It looks like an Indian guy and his gal are doing it. Best I can tell, it's not quite how I do it. It's kind of doggy style, but one leg is straight. That's all I got on that page. Next page, same guy, same gal. This time, it's like someone tipped him over on their side, like cow tipping. Next page, I've got like 10 pages. It's like he passed out maybe a few too many brewskis, and she's hopping around like a frog over him. He wakes up in the middle of that. They decide to do it.
I would buy that. I would absolutely download that. So the show, a season finale, you have such an incredible cast. Glenn Howard and Patton Oswalt. Paula Pell, those kids are great. The teachers are great. Has it been awesome working with a cast like that?
They are unbelievable. Everybody was, like, above and beyond what I was hoping from them. They're all so talented, so funny. The kids were all wonderful surprises, not having known them. I was already a Glenn Howard and Paula Pell and Patton fan. And the three teachers, Mary, Lyric, and Jean, are improvising hilarious things. I was so proud and so happy to let that cast just take the scripts and elevate them. It was really wonderful.
Well, you guys have all done an incredible job. Thank you so much for being here, buddy.
Thank you,
always
buddy.
Such a pleasure.
Thank you, buddy.
Mike O'Brien, everybody. Season finale of AP Bio airs Thursday night at 8:30 here on NBC.
Hey, everybody. It's the Late Night Podcast. And I'm here with Mike O'Brien, and I'm so happy you're here. How are you, buddy?
I'm good. Thank you, Seth. How are you?
Good. I want to talk about AP Bio, but I also want to talk about your, how much you remember of when you auditioned for SNL, because I was there. It was at I.O. in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
You played the spoons, if I remember.
That's right. Yes, I had a instructor. It was based on when I was a freshman in college, my dorm roommate, so it's like a tiny room at Michigan, and my roommate Tommy was a speed metal guitar enthusiast and he was very nice. I was on the rowing team, so I had to get up at like 5 a.m and he was very nice about jamming out late night with headphones on, so I would just hear what sounds like the string strumming. And then he didn't know, because it was blaring speed metal in his ear, in his headphones, but that he grunts all the time throughout. So I was in that audition that you guys saw in Chicago playing a spoons instructor who would play the spoons, and the whole time he was playing like a very simple spoons beat. He was like, which was what I would go to bed listening to every night.
I remember, and again, tell me if I'm wrong, you also brought your chair to the very front of the stage. You were very close to myself and Lorne Michaels, and I remember thinking, this is such a powerful move, because it's terrifying to audition for Lorne and,
yes,
and anyone associated with the show when that's where you want to work. And you just brought that chair right up, and I thought, this guy's ready to own it.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I didn't think about that much at the time, but I was definitely...
That was just your blocking from when you'd done it before?
yeah. That's where the X was. No, I'd been flown out once before, not hired. They went with Sandberg or someone that didn't work out, and I just was like a little over it, which is kind of the only way you get hired to SNL, or the best way is I'd moved on with my life. I was thinking about what I would go do in LA soon, and my mind was fully there, and it was like, Lauren's coming next week, do you want to do this 5-minute thing? I'm like, sure. And it's the best tone to like come into that audition.
The first time you auditioned, I'm remembering now as well, you took a picture with Lorne, is that?
Yeah. Were you in that room?
I don't think I was in that room. I think I heard that story after the
fact. Because I have that photo also. It was when Tina was head writer, 2005 maybe, but you were...
I was there, but maybe not quite in room for auditions yet.
What were you, what was your, were you a cast member?
I was
at
a cast
moment?
Member there.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, and I assumed I would never see any of these people ever again, or be in this building again, or New York. I'd never even been to New York. And so I just took pictures the whole time. And then I did a terrible audition. It had literally improv where I needed a suggestion at one point in it. And I think Tina gave me a suggestion, but they were definitely like, what do you mean? I was like, give me a suggestion. They're like, you're not hired. That's your suggestion. But at the end, I was like, can I take a picture of you guys? And I took a picture of the auditors. I'll show it to you. I don't know if you can, if you post with this podcast, but it's really funny who was like, you know, Higgins is laughing. There's people who are like, I get a kick out of this. And some people who are like, I hate this. I'm mad. And Lauren was smiling. And then I was like, and can you guys take a picture of me? And Aaron David tried to grab the camera. And I was like, yeah. I want the little Canadian fella to take it.
So you made Lauren take the picture.
Yes. Yeah.
And then it took him 4 years to forget who you were.
Yep.
And then hired you.
I was able to erase what I'm sure he probably didn't find the coolest. Although who knows?
Like, I think he did. And I will auditors, say my other memory of watching you audition at I.O. in Chicago, it was so rare for something, which I think makes sense and is very fair, to surprise Lauren in a way that delighted him. I think he has seen so many people audition in so many ways, and so many people audition, which is not a bad choice. They audition to be on SNL, and so they think, what does SNL want to see? And a lot of people come to the same conclusion and do the same kind of things. So for Lorne to see somebody do audition playing the spoons and grunting, I feel like was new territory for him.
Yeah.
And so he really laughed, and I just remember thinking, oh, this is really great. Because there's nothing more fun than when Lauren likes a thing that you also like.
Yeah. I mean, and he is like a really good laugher. People don't realize like he's great on Wednesdays. Like he'll genuinely laugh really hard and give it up for bits. The other one I did at that I.O., I was hosting it, and I did a bit where we'd keep restarting because we were taping it, and each time we restarted, we listened to like a full half of a Nickelback song. And yeah, I don't know if he was as big a fan of that one, but the like immediately like, welcome, now I'm going to torture you.
I was there for that too.
That's the Spoon, same as the Spoon.
That was Spoon night as well. Yeah, that was a great night. So you still improvise, yeah? With your old team, Reckoning?
Yep.
The Reckoning?
Yeah, we still we had a weekly slot at IO West, which unfortunately closed down, but we bounced around town in LA, is where 7 of the 10 are, and doing improv and
how stuff. Often were you doing it?
We were every week for 17 years in Chicago or LA, and sometimes about like 5 and 5 in both. And now it's every week or two. We still do it and stuff.
So I spent exactly 1 hour of one day in the writer's room for AP Bio. Mm-hmm. It happens in LA. I think I would have been there more often if it was here.
Yeah.
Not a ton, but I would have been there. But I was so taken with, obviously we share an improv background, we share an SNL background. Mm-hmm. I think SNL is very helpful for the show I do now. I don't know which of your skill sets is more helpful for what you're doing right now, because it seemed like a totally foreign thing to me, not having ever worked in a sitcom room.
Yeah, I think it, and by the way, it was so fun when you and Shoemaker came by and everyone was kind of like fired up and like their best selves. Definitely. Yeah. It was because it's a day in, day out type thing. And then all of a sudden you've got these two really funny people who I refer to constantly as having just gotten off the phone with or whatever. That was a really fun day. But it might be like most similar to like coaching improv and directing sketch shows in Chicago or something. Like it definitely was one of those things where me being a little late to everything, like it took 9 years of Chicago improv life before I wrote for SNL, and 8 or 9 years later that I sold a sitcom and everything, that like you can draw from these things. Because otherwise, yeah, I don't know how sitcoms are run, you know. Like I was on Simon Rich's show Man Seeking Woman, and that was very helpful, and I was pulling a lot from how Simon ran that, how you ran like Thursday rewrites. It's a little like Thursdays at SNL, and your vibe there was very helpful, and like let's get 3 more options and then let's move along. Like I had some of the timing, mm-hmm, of like not trying to not waste people's time in the back of my head, but yeah, a little bit of winging it, and occasionally pulling aside more experienced sitcom people at the end of a week and being like, does that look and sound like a sitcom room?
I think it's great because, you know, it's a network sitcom, but it also, your DNA is still very much ingrained in it, which I thought was really impressive, that despite going through this process that sometimes can flatten out the personality of the creator, it still is there. But you also told, and people will hear this after the finale, which is a day after we're recording this, but it really, your first season had this really nice arc over the course of its 13 episodes. And was that something that you were concerned with the whole time, of making sure this character and the story more than the character even started here and got there?
Yeah, I mean, it became like a real gift and a little bit of a burden. You know, they tested it to people, like the pilot and different shows, and they were like, what do you think this is on? That's part of the testing. And like 85% said it seems like a Netflix show. And NBC seemed more than fine with that. They're like, okay, good. And that was interesting to me. And I think we made kind of a Netflix-y show. Maybe we don't want to give them credit for having invented the idea of an arc. but for NBC. And so it really did. And it became like the final 2 or 3 episodes were really hard. And I'm very satisfied by how they came out. But we really were like, and also we should tie up this story, this one, and this guy should have to face this big issue he's been having to face. And part of me was like watching a lot of Cheers. And, was like, also, it's okay if we get a season two or three to just have kind of some small resolutions and not have it be like a True Detective or something. But I kind of like that we bit that off. It was a hard couple of weeks where we were really banging our heads on the final two. But it's satisfying to me to watch now. It does feel like a contained story.
I would also argue True Detective had a bad resolution.
I just saw the first one.
Yeah, the first one was such wonderful television.
Yeah.
And I thought they were so great, and I thought that guy built a world. And then when it ended, I really thought, oh, this didn't resolve particularly well for me.
Yeah, I remember, isn't the bad guy like running around with a mask on and then he shoots him or something?
Yeah.
I guess he gets lost for a minute in that maze.
Was a weird maze. I had a lot of maze questions. Also, I was, when everybody, like, I feel like McConaughey maybe got, like, shot 15 times, and then Woody Harrelson got, like, stabbed with a sword, and then they were both okay, and I thought, I thought this was going to be a different kind of show.
Is like, a big part of this podcast is, like, trying to remember shows you and the guests have seen a year or two ago. Yeah.
That's, we're going
to
build this as a season one recap of True Detective.
I have a question, jumping back to what we were originally talking about. What did you think of the scouting trips? When you would go with SNL to scout people at Groundlings, at Second City, IO, UCB, was it exciting and cool to you? Was it cringy? I only did it the one time, and I was kind of fresh out of that world, so I didn't love it. But was that an exciting, cool week or not as fun?
In the beginning, it was super cool. Like, just the idea of going on vacation with work friends is awesome. And staying at a hotel and going to dinners and talking about comedy. And also, I felt like it was when you got to know Lauren a little bit better.
Yep.
Because it was a small group of people. It was a lot. It was stressful at times when it was people you still were connected with in Chicago. I feel like by the time I was going, enough years had passed that it was people I sort of knew through other people like yourself, as opposed to the people that I was improvising with.
Right.
It was cringy at times, but so were the auditions here. You know, but that's just because the stakes are so high.
Right.
The thing that I always thought was really cool about Lauren was there are two shows at Second City at any given time. There's Second City and Second City ETC.
Yeah.
And there's only six people in each show. And it would be floated every now and then. Why don't we go see the first act of the main stage show and then go see the second act of the ETC show? That way, we'll knock out in one night, we'll see 12 really talented people.
Yeah.
And Lauren and a couple other people had this philosophy, which I thought was really cool, that if somebody's best thing was in the second act of a show that you only sold the first act, their whole life they'll be of the mind that I missed my chance because like the coin flip came up tails when I needed to be heads. So we'd always go spend one night at ETC. We'd always go spend one night at main stage. We also started doing IO nights, which was an idea I had. And that was where we found Vanessa, maybe Cecily. I can't remember if that's where we found her. Maybe 80. Mm-hmm. But it was because then all of a sudden you widened out from just 12 people to you could, over the course of a weekend, maybe see like 30 to 40 people.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember the year I was involved in it, I was in too deep. I had just been a part of this community for 9 years. And so everyone I saw, I had this like intimate connection with. And at the dinner afterwards, I remember them casually being like, tossing it over to me a few times. They're like, we kind of like this person, we kind of like that person. Mike, do you know this one? And I'd be like, yeah, that's my brother-in-law. And they're like, and how about this one? I'm like, I'm currently dating her. And they're like, how about that one? And those were all really on a short list. We're like current family and friends. I'm like, yeah, that one, I went through a very intense 6-year period with. Like, it was not a good auditor of talent. It's at that point in my life.
One of the angriest I ever was we did a night at IO, and Sharna, who runs IO, basically the way we laid it out is can you have like pick 15 people, 5 minutes each?
Yeah.
And it's very much about like the time that anyone is willing to spend watching people audition because it just can be a long night for everyone involved. And then you're not doing any favors to the people at the back end of the evening. And again, this wasn't Sharna's fault, but it did kind of, and I get like you, when you go into this world and you kind of like drop like a nuclear bomb and when you leave, there's like ash. Cause she was like, can we bring, instead of 15, can I do 20? And you are like, okay, I get that this world you live in, I'm asking you like just a statistical, I want a statistical answer, but you have like personalities and people you need to do it. And so it was like 20. And then I just remember it's like 20 people, 5 minutes. You're like, this is, you know, if there's just a little bit of time in between them, like maybe we get out of here in 2 hours. And like the first person went 9 minutes. And I just was like, oh, this is, and it was this most stressful night. Cause then you're next to Lauren and Lauren's checking his watch. And it's like, you feel bad for everybody who was only doing 5 minutes. It was awful.
I remember a girl that night went 17. And then we had to go tell a bunch of super nervous people pacing in a green room. We're going to call it a night. Lauren wants to leave. And to his credit, he added a whole other, another like 2 hour night the next night. Like, they're good about that. And what Sharna could have used is a little more tough love about like, you're getting a shot at this. You don't need 17 minutes. Yeah. Like
it. I mean, there's an interesting thing for anybody who's listening, whoever gets a chance for this or any other situation where people say, give yourself 5 minutes. Like, no one's ever mad about the person who went four.
Yeah.
And I get that also as performers, and especially performers that in comedy where it's about risk taking, people think that there's a boldness or brashness to making a choice outside the lines of what you're given. But when it's time, you're never not taking it from someone else.
You also don't get... early on, and I still have trouble with this, but that your voice comes out in each piece. It's not, they're not all as different as you think, you know, like I'm a giraffe doing stand up, and I'm a Chicago guy who's doing this, and I'm a something else. And I'm like, well, I should show all three of those so they know my range. And all three are like a very, very clear, similar voice that 10 seconds into the first one of them, they're like, yes or no.
I feel like Sandberg had the best audition as far as it was. Mm-hmm. So like, here's a very short burst what I'm going to show you. I think he did like Out of Breath Jogger and then maybe Animal the Muppet drumming. And it was some version of that where you're like, okay, we get it. That's just, you will, no one else is doing this. You fit in perfectly.
Yeah. If you don't like this, you're not going to like me. And it's like, great. Yeah.
You and I are going to go out to dinner.
Yes.
Let's just be honest with everybody. And I hope they got a lot out of this podcast. And let's go have some steaks.
That sounds great.
All right.
Thanks, Seth.
Want more Late Night with Seth Meyers? Be sure to follow the handle at Late Night Seth on Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, Instagram, and Snapchat. You can also watch full episodes of Late Night at LateNightSeth.com or on the NBC app. And please tell your friends who are fans of Seth Meyers to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes.
I feel like I was blindsided.
Because it's a competition show.
From the producers of Jury Duty and The Bachelor.
We have scoured the earth for the 14 greatest reality contestants that were available during our production window.
Comes a reality competition show about reality competition shows.
Nobody has dared to find out who is the actual best at just being on a reality show. I'm your host, comedian Daniel Tosh.
It's win or go home.
Each episode, our contestants will face new challenges that will test their strength and lack of life skills for a chance to win $200
million.
$200,000.
Prepare, because it's about to be ugly, crying, lots of fighting.
Tayshia, I have to defend myself.
Celebrating 25 years of reality TV with your favorites.
I have diarrhea. You cannot do this to me.
What in gay hell have I got myself into?
The GOAT, premiering on Freevee and Prime Video on May 9th.